This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The guy's only been on the job a couple of months, so you'd think he'd get a little room to breathe. But maybe that's the problem. Maybe Tim Geithner's got too much room at Treasury. Can you save the global economy all by yourself? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the Kirby bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 13th of March, and that makes today day number 53 of the Obama administration. A little more than 6 weeks. Barely enough time for cabinet secretaries to learn their way around the White House, much less figure out how to save the world. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has arguably the second hardest job in this country, behind his boss, of course, and he's doing it without all the help he ought to have. Many of the department's top staff jobs have yet to be filled. Geithner himself is being criticized, sharply sometimes too. You know, Washington can be a tough town, and these days Wall Street is an even tougher audience. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
For some of the American public, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner has become the man without a plan.
I'm Timothy Geithner.
This was Saturday Night Live's opener last weekend, a Geithner impersonator offering up a new bailout.
This $420 billion will be placed in a special fund and will go to the first individual who comes up with a workable plan to solve the banking crisis.
And for the past 2 days, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs has had to defend Geithner and the Treasury Department in his daily briefing.
Whether it's financial stability, home foreclosure, recovery and reinvestment, creating jobs, putting money into taxpayers' pockets.
Gibbs argued Geithner has accomplished a tremendous amount. Roger Altman, a former Clinton Treasury official, agrees.
They have rolled out 4 huge initiatives in the past 50 days.
The stimulus, revising the bank bailout, a foreclosure plan, and plans to remove bad assets from bank books. But many on Wall Street want more details about that and are getting impatient. And they worry more high-level staff aren't in place. But Alice Rivlin at Brookings says moving too fast on any front would be an even bigger mistake.
Those things are bound to take time.
Insiders acknowledge that finding advisors with expertise in complex financial deals who don't have conflicts of interest is hard. But the Treasury Department says it's ahead of previous administrations filling key slots. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Crude oil dropped today down less than a buck to $46.25 a barrel. Told you that as a way to get to this, that the trade deficit has fallen to its lowest level in more than 6 years. Part of that, of course, is the recession. We're just not buying like we used to from overseas or anyplace. But the oil that we are importing is relatively cheaper than it used to be. That, combined with shrinking U.S. demand for crude, is keeping consumers happy at the pump. But for the OPEC oil ministers meeting this weekend in Vienna, it is a major headache, as Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
If it was just about supply and demand, OPEC's decision next Sunday would be easy. Cut output as a way to shore up flagging oil prices. But throw in the sinking global economy and things get complicated. Tom Closa is an analyst with the Oil Price Information Service.
If the price goes too high, this severe recession could deepen and drive consumption lower,
causing oil prices to drop even more. He says that's the last thing OPEC countries want. But the fact that today's oil prices are down about $100 a barrel from last summer's peak has OPEC leaders in a pickle.
The problem is that their budgets and their capital expenses and what they need for their social agendas, you know, requires much, much higher prices than what their production costs are and much higher prices than we're seeing now.
Global oil demand is expected to fall again this year, according to the International Energy Agency. Analysts say if OPEC curbs supplies to raise prices, it could backfire. Prices will eventually rise again on their own. But oil expert Daniel Yergin says how soon doesn't depend on OPEC. It depends on the G20 meeting next month in London.
The decisions that the major economies make about stimulating their economies, the decisions they make about furthering economic recovery, that's what will really determine the future price of oil.
And as for today's oil prices, Yergin says OPEC should be happy they're not any lower than they already are. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Holding Company has gotten a financial poke in the eye. It lost its AAA credit rating today. The downgrade from Fitch, that's one of the big three credit rating agencies, leaves Berkshire at what's called AA+. That means it has a slightly higher risk of defaulting on its debt than it did before. The decision by Fitch came just hours after S&P did the same thing to General Electric. It is now at AA+ as well. And that means each company is going to have to pay more to borrow money. Not necessarily a good thing in a time of tight credit. Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson with more now on rating deflation.
So what does it mean to be AAA? It's kind of like the way the credit card companies look at you if you've got a great FICO score.
You are going to pay back your debt without any doubt.
Nick Riccio is managing director in corporate ratings at Standard & Poor's. He says the number of companies that can pay back their debt without any doubt has been falling for years.
There are five left. All right. At one time, that number was about 32. But over the last couple of decades, we've been kind of sliding a little bit.
More than a little bit. Riccio says the vast majority of American companies are rated junk these days. Gerald Epstein is an economist at the University of Massachusetts. He says with these downgrades, the rating agencies are just stating the obvious.
Anybody who looks carefully at what's going on in the financial markets know that Berkshire Hathaway is... It has some investments that are in trouble. You don't really need the credit rating agencies to tell you that.
Epstein says agencies like S&P lost his confidence when they failed to rate mortgage-backed bonds correctly. He says their ratings on companies are more reliable, but he says they're not quick enough on the draw.
They really, in a sense, contribute to the business cycle by the way that they do these ratings. I would prefer to see them do ratings in a much more long-term kind of way rather than going up with the cycle and being over-pessimistic on the way down.
Epstein says until the rating agencies get more transparent about the way they do business, that extra A in the rating doesn't mean much. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street made it four in a row today, but without a whole lot of enthusiasm. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those famed secret Swiss bank accounts are going to be getting a little less secret. The Swiss finance minister said today he's going to loosen up secrecy laws there to keep Switzerland off a European blacklist of tax havens. Back here at home, it's not tax havens so much that politicians are worried about as tax increases. President Obama is going to have to deal with criticism from both sides of the aisle in Congress as he works out his budget plan for next year. Commentator Amity Schles says the discussion can't forget the lower ends of the tax charts.
Taxation without representation. That's what our nation's founders rebelled against. Subjects in the colonies were sending money home to the crown without getting say in their own government. The course of U.S. history can be seen as progress by those who are taxed to get representation. Think of women with the 19th Amendment. Along the way, we began to pay out money to groups that paid no income tax at all. There's Medicare, of course, for senior citizens, even if they never worked. Welfare for the poor and struggling, at least through the 90s. And more recently, there's the Earned Income Tax Credit, a break for low-income workers. The credit was designed to make people want to work and to offset their heavy pension payments for Social Security. The result of expanding it, however, is that many people who work don't pay income tax. Instead, they get money back. Do we want to help weaker citizens, especially in downturns? Totally. In fact, both parties have plans that relieve yet more taxpayers of their burden. Republicans like payroll tax holidays, and the Obama administration is zeroing out the income tax obligations of yet more citizens. But a tipping point does come. when too many are paying out and too few are paying in. Maybe that tipping point is now. Today, households in the bottom half of earners pay only 4% of the income taxes. One tiny group, the top 1%, pays close to 40%. This can slow the economic recovery we're waiting for. Top earners won't want to keep producing if their burden gets much heavier. But the more important problem is a problem of civics. All presidents talk about the need for community. We strengthen that sense of community when everyone has to pay some taxes. Like jury duty, paying taxes reminds you that you are part of something. It reminds you of what you owe, not just what's owed you. The mood of the skeptics today is just the reverse of the mood at the Boston Tea Party. Then we said no taxation without representation. Today, try flipping that line. No representation without taxation.
Amity Schles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can send us your thoughts about what you hear on the broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. Look for that link that says contact. In more normal times, 10% jumps in the major stock market indices would set off all kinds of hooting and hollering. But when you're down as far as we are, those gains are just a reminder of how far we have to go to get back, which, as it happens, is a long, long way. To help us wrap up the week on Wall Street and beyond, we've got Felix Salmon with us once again. He's at Portfolio.com. Lee Gallagher is a senior editor at Fortune Magazine. Hi again, guys.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Good to be here, Kai.
All right. Topic of the day, gang, is the stock market to begin with. Is this rally real or not real? Discuss. Lee, go.
Well, I have to tell you, I think that it's not real. I think this is a bear market rally. And, you know, I thought that yesterday when my mother, who doesn't really know about finance, and called and said, this is a bear market rally, isn't
it? Your mom, too? She did that? Yeah.
Yes, and I think she's right. And, you know, I'll tell you why. I mean, you know, there was obviously some very, very small glimmers of positive news from the banks. And I think the market is so, so susceptible psychologically to any glimmer of hope that they're just ready to take it and run with it. And that's exactly what happened.
Okay, but wait a second, Felix. Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citigroup, came out and said, hey, we're in the black. Jamie Dimon said, hey, we're in the black. I mean, that has to be not bad news.
Well, they've always been in the black on an operating basis. The question is how much in terms of write-downs are they going to take?
Ah.
And you only know at the end of the quarter how much write-downs you've decided to take. So it might well be that on an operating basis they made money in January and February. And that, in the grand scheme of things, is probably good news. But ultimately, we don't know whether these banks are going to make money or lose money this quarter until the quarter is over.
And of course, we don't know how much more writing down there may be in future quarters. Right, Felix?
Every time they've taken a write down, people have said, is this it? Is this the last of the write downs? And they've said, yes, we think so. We don't know for sure, but we think so. And then the next quarter, they've taken an even bigger write down.
All right, let me delve briefly into the political here, Lee. And I want to talk to you about the Treasury Secretary. As we heard up at the top of the broadcast, he's all alone in that big building next to the White House. They're having trouble filling the jobs. Is that really a big problem in terms of getting this economy back on track, or is it just much hullabaloo about nothing?
Well, I think it's part of the problem. I mean, I think the problem with Tim Geithner is that from day one, he was sort of introduced as this is going to be the person who is going to take us out of this crisis, and then he sort of whiffed. And from there, it has just been, you know, nonstop criticism, and he's been held to this huge high standard, and there's been a lot of expectations placed on him. So it's sort of mixed. I mean, is it all his fault? Probably not. On the other hand, he hasn't exactly led, I think, the way that people have expected and hoped. A lot will probably depend on what happens with this so-called stress test, because that is his idea. That's his own stress test, you might say.
Yeah, you might. Felix, what do you think?
I think Lee's right. I think that we have seen a distinct lack of leadership from Treasury. If anything, most of the leadership on an economic front has come from Larry Summers in the White House. And I think that has marginalized Tim Geithner. I think that Tim has failed to communicate to Wall Street that he deserves their trust and that he knows what he's doing. And now that he's lost that trust, I fear that it's pretty much impossible for him to regain it. And this could be a big problem going forwards, because if you have a Treasury Secretary which doesn't have the trust of the markets, there's almost nothing that Treasury Secretary can do right.
Before I let you go, guys, I want to get your take on the media war of the week. Jon Stewart from The Daily Show, Jim Cramer from CNBC, they've been going back and forth all week. Cramer went on Stewart's show last night. Guys, does this really mean anything, or is it all just nothing?
Well, as somebody said, he might want a job at the Daily Show. I mean, I think people were surprised at how non-argumentative it was, to say the least. But it's certainly made for some entertaining conversations around our morning meeting. I will say that for sure.
Felix, you you actually have been on CNBC. You've been a resident of the Decca Box. What'd you think? And does it really matter? I mean, is this all just nothingness?
CNBC is hurting America, and it's high time that people like Jon Stewart really took them to task. And this should be the end of CNBC as a useful, important media force. It won't be. They're going to continue going on, and a bunch of people are going to watch it. But really, you get much more useful information from Marketplace, frankly.
Aw, shucks. Felix Salmon at Portfolio.com. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, the beginning of the end 1 year ago.
Bear probably could have stayed afloat, but it was a big player in subprime and, you know, was notorious for its risk-taking.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street went out on a high note today, ending its best week since November. The Dow Industrials rose 53 points, 0.75%, closed at 7,223. NASDAQ gained 5 points, 0.33%, settled at 1431. The S&P 500 rebounded 5 points, 0.75%, wrapped up at 756. For the week that was, the Dow gained 9%. The NASDAQ bounced 10.6%. The S&P 500 added 10.7%. Healthcare stocks helped give the markets a shot in the arm. Humana, the second largest provider of U.S. health benefits, jumped 7.75% today. An analyst upgrade pumped up Merck's shares. Coventry Healthcare grabbed 7.5% today. Bond prices fell. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board releases its monthly report on industrial production. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a hearing on global counterterrorism efforts. And new labels should be showing up on meat products in your local grocery store. Country of origin labels, or COOL for short, are required on some products starting March 16th. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You remember late last summer when it seemed like every weekend there was some huge government intervention designed to save the global economy from disaster? All right, good. Now think back a little bit farther than that, to last spring. A year ago, this coming weekend, the first of those Sunday night rescues was the bailout of a bank called Bear Stearns. Thanks to $29 billion from the Fed, Bear was saved from complete collapse. But for the 14,000 people who work there, things changed literally overnight. Marketplace's Amy Scott caught up with some of them to find out what they're doing 1 year on.
The banks did the deal on a Sunday night. The next day was St. Patrick's Day. Francie Heller remembers looking down from her third floor office at the spectacle below.
There were some Scottish men in skirts practicing their bagpipes, and there was the CNBC cameras and people wearing their red gloves from the cold.
There were 14,000.
There were people there handing out $2 bills. And there were also people there handing out cards for looking at, do you need to sell your apartment or look for an apartment? There were real estate agents. So it was a real scene. It was like a real circus outside my window all day long.
For the next few months, Heller kept coming to the office. She worked with pensions, endowments, and foundations at Bayer. But there was nothing to do.
J.P. Morgan had a bunch of meetings, and we all listened, and there were people walking around noting office numbers and writing down, putting tickets on your computers, and so we had no idea what was going to happen when.
So, like many of her colleagues, Heller used the time and the office resources to find a job. She eventually found work with a hedge fund manager. She's still there. Like so many at Bear Stearns, Heller didn't just lose her job. A big chunk of her pay was in stock. Ultimately, shareholders got $10 a share in the takeover. The stock had been trading at $70 just a week before the deal. Averill Rye worked in the corporate strategy division at Bear Stearns. He's now head of investment banking at a small firm called Pally Capital. He lost millions of dollars.
It still hurts to see that go. It sets you back, but, you know, it's certainly not devastation, which I'm sure that some other people went through who had spent longer time there.
Rye and Heller were lucky enough to find jobs before the whole industry crumbled. Justin Brannan had been at Bear Stearns for about a year and a half. He had a lower-level job in the hedge fund unit.
We supported all those guys that kind of brought the house down.
After the house fell, he got by for a while making $7 an hour as a stockbroker trainee. But when that ended recently, he faced a lot more competition for work.
It's just scorched earth out there. You're up against people that are way more qualified and rightfully so. I mean, I hope they get the jobs, you know, that they deserve.
Brannan just found a job off Wall Street. He'll be raising money for a nonprofit humanitarian group.
I have a special person that I'm going to be introducing, Delilah Rothenberg.
Fellow Bear alum Delilah Rothenberg has taken a similar path. She spends a lot of her newfound free time volunteering. She helped organize this recent benefit for a Rwandan beauty school.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome.
Rothenberg worked with institutional investors at Bear Stearns. She pays the bills now doing financial consulting. She'd never really pictured a long career on Wall Street. She got into finance to do economic development in Africa, but she got comfortable at Bear.
It was almost too great to leave, so maybe it was a mixed blessing that my opportunities there ended, otherwise I'd never continue on with life.
Everyone I talk to misses Bear Stearns. They talk about the bank's demise almost like a death. A year later, some are angry at the people who made the bad decisions, but mostly they're still just kind of stunned. The other day, Francie Heller says she was watching the sunset.
And there was this beautiful sun, and it just seemed to sink a little, and then boom, it was gone. And I think that was the way it felt at Bear. Then it was just such a surprise and so unexpected that it was just gone.
When the sun set so abruptly on Bear Stearns, Heller says it felt like the end. Now she realizes it was just the beginning. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Even a year later, it's not entirely clear what the near death of Bear Stearns means. Washington saved Bear, but let Lehman go under 6 months later. And we are $700 billion into a bailout of the entire financial industry, with who knows how much more to come. James Surowiecki is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He writes the financial page for the magazine. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Are you surprised at all about where Bear Stearns has left us come today?
Well, I am surprised. I think what I would say is I actually don't really think that Bear per se left us where we are. But the reason I'm so surprised is I actually had kind of thought the government had a handle on the situation. And so I really was fairly confident that the downside damage was going to be relatively contained. And, you know, I could not have been more wrong.
Well, let's play a little what if here. What if there had been more money available to Bear Stearns? What if the Fed had opened up its liquidity windows? What if Secretary Paulson had been a little bit more proactive at the time? Could Bear really have been saved instead of just being sucked up into J.P. Morgan?
My suspicion is that if the window had been opened, in other words, if investment banks had been able to borrow from the Fed as they were after Bear Stearns, Bear probably could have stayed afloat. But I do think that there were fundamental issues with the company. I mean, it was a relatively small investment bank. It was a big player in subprime and, you know, was notorious for its risk-taking. And so while it's certainly possible that they could have stayed afloat, I think the lack of confidence that people had in Bear by late February, early March would have made it hard for them to construct a really good business going forward.
You wrote, actually, at some point in the magazine in a piece about Bear Stearns, you said, you know, it's a good thing that Bear survived. It's also a good thing that it almost died. Explain that for us, would you?
Well, what I meant by that was that I really thought that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department had to come to the rescue. If it had genuinely failed in the way that Lehman eventually did, that it would have really wreaked havoc. But what I thought at the time was that the fact that Bear Stearns shareholders in particular were, you know, pretty severely punished. The initial price that the deal was done at was $2 a share.
Right.
And I thought that was really important because, you know, that was going to make the Wall Street decision makers more cautious going forward. It was going to make investors more skeptical. And so I thought all of that together meant that it was unlikely we were going to get another Bear Stearns. Lehman Brothers appears to have taken away the lesson in part that, you know, since the liquidity window was open and since they had come in some late form to the rescue of Bear, that it wasn't necessary to be as cautious as they should have been.
As we try to make our way through what is left of the banking crisis in this country, whether it's almost over or has a ways to run yet, do the lessons of Bear apply?
You know, for me, the lesson is systemic risk exists and that if you don't act, then, you know, the problems are going to get worse rather than better. But I think, you know, the original sin was committed much longer ago. It was when we allowed these institutions to get too big and too important to the system as a whole, and when we allowed companies like Bear Stearns to leverage themselves up 30 or 40 times, you know, when they were able to borrow so much money that even a small decline in the value of their assets basically could threaten the existence of the entire firm. So I think those are the two key lessons that I get from Bear Stearns.
James Surowiecki, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes today, California's budget gap is back. Just a couple of weeks ago, state lawmakers in what would be the world's seventh, or maybe by now it's the eighth largest economy, made a deal to close a $42 billion hole in their finances. They may want to get back to work sometime soon, too. The state's legislative analyst said today falling revenues have sent California $8 billion back into the red. And speaking of institutions without a whole lot of money, the White House Automotive Task Force has hired a bankruptcy lawyer, you know, just to advise them on their options for Detroit. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 53 points, 0.75%, closed at 7,223, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, 0.33%, settled at 1431. The S&P 500 rebounded 5 points, 0.75%, wrapped up trading at 756. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. York. Coming up on Monday, why the world needs more rich people.
We need to supply equipment that's too expensive for individual labs to purchase that, you know, may cost $1 million in some cases. So more than ever, we really need private philanthropy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.